It was made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring a weekend of jazz when vibraphone master Stefan Harris performs with both his ensemble Blackout and the U of I Concert Jazz Band. And the trio Is What offers its special brand of jazzy hip-hop during a free lobby concert. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. In the old city of Lahore, Pakistan, a brothel quarter exists. There for centuries, women have been trained to be dancing girls, serving as courtesans for emperors and other elites. But today, the ghetto is in decline, and the patrons are no longer elite, but lower and middle class men. The artful singing and dancing of the courtesans of old is all but gone. But women continue to live in the quarter, and the men continue to patronize them. On the program today, a glimpse into the lives of the women of Hiramandi, the old brothel quarter of Lahore. Our guest is sociologist Louise Brown, a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Birmingham in England. Her latest book is The Dancing Girls of Lahore, Selling Love and Saving Dreams in Pakistan's Ancient Pleasure District. Here is how Louise Brown describes the quarter early in the book. Hiramandi, the diamond market, is a crumbling ghetto of 3- and 4-story buildings tucked into the northern corner of the walled city, right next to one of the greatest forts of Mughal India and its biggest, most perfectly proportioned mosque. The old women living here say it has been the red light district for as long as they can remember, and it flourished long before the British arrived in the mid-19th century. Also known as Shahi Mohalla, the district was important then, and in its heyday it trained courtesans who won the hearts of emperors. The old ladies insist that things used to be different in those times. Women like them were respected. They were artists, not dirty prostitutes. That from Louise Brown's book, The Dancing Girls of Lahore. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions for our guest, Louise Brown. You can join us with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. The Dancing Girls of Lahore, Selling Love and Saving Dreams in Pakistan's Ancient Pleasure District, is published by Fourth Estate, and that's an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon. Louise Brown, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Louise Brown? Hello?
Hello, sorry.
Hello.
Can you
hear me?
Pleased to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Would you please describe the old walled city of Lahore for us?
It's an area that's been inhabited for maybe 300 or 400 years, and it's really the heart of the city of Lahore. It was surrounded by a large defensive wall, which now doesn't exist, but the people of the old city continue to build their houses as if the wall still exist. It's really nowadays the kind of the poorest part of Lahore, apart from the shanty towns which exist right on the fringes. It's an area which is dilapidated, but which in many respects holds a lot of the history of the city. You know, many of its most wonderful mosques, its most interesting markets.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that you say about the city of Lahore, that it is the cultural center of the Punjab. What would you like us to know about the region?
And the region itself was part of what used to be British India. And there's a big difference, really, between the north of the subcontinent and the south of the subcontinent. The north of the subcontinent, which includes modern-day India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, was heavily influenced by Muslim culture, Islamic culture. And what we see in places like Lahore, also in Delhi and spreading across into Bangladesh, is this very kind of a heavy influence from Islam, and that we can contrast that with many parts of the south of the subcontinent. The Punjab itself was one, it continues today to be one of the richest parts of the subcontinent, and certainly in terms of the north of the subcontinent, it was one of its cultural centres. The Punjab means where the five rivers meet, and it was a very fertile agricultural plain, which was a centre for development of civilizations and cultures. One of the earliest civilizations in the world developed in the area of these five rivers in the Indus Valley.
Yeah. Well, once you say the city, the area was a multi-faith and multicultural city, and this area, this district, Hiramandi, was much more prosperous. What had the city and the district been like in those days, if I could use the word, in their heyday?
Well, the heyday was probably pre-partition in the 1920s and in the 1930s. And in those days, Lahore was a multicultural, multi-faith city, so you've got Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs living together in Lahore. And Hiramandi was the kind of playground, if you like, particularly for elites. The elites who were firstly from the landed aristocracy, but also the urban intelligentsia.
Yeah. Now, the mixture of peoples and cultures at that time, does that continue in any shape or form today?
In a very limited way, because what happened during partition, 1947, is that the people who were Hindus and many of the Sikhs who were living in Lahore fled to India, and many of the Muslims who were living in India fled to places like Lahore. And so it's not that same multi-faith and multicultural city as it was 60 or 70 years ago.
Hmm. The women of this area, the old women, told you that things used to be very different, and they said to you, we had high status, we were respected, we were trained as singers and dancers, we practiced for hours every day. Are they correct?
I think they are correct in many respects. There's a tradition in the Indian subcontinent, a linking of dancing and entertainment and singing with high-level cultural performance, but also with, I wouldn't say prostitution, but with providing entertainment services for elites. And the women who would provide those kind of services to men who would be the aristocracy or the urban intelligentsia were women who were very highly trained, and it was a skilled profession. So very much like the geishas in Japan, they were women who would have been trained from the age of about 7 years old to sing and to dance, to recite poetry. They were literate women. And so what the old women are talking about is actually true. There is a historical basis to their life stories.
Yeah. How did these women come to become these trained singers and dancers? Where did they come from?
It's very difficult to find the origins of these women, because we're talking about a social system that developed hundreds, maybe even thousands of years ago. But in traditional Indian society, and here I'm talking about Hindu society, there were people who were given a status, a social status, according to their occupation. And this became a kind of caste status. And that status was transferred from the parents to their children. So somebody who was identified, who became an entertainer, for example, someone who was a singer and a dancer and a woman who provided sexual services, was categorized into a particular kind of social category. And her daughters, in turn, would be born into that same profession. It was not something that you could escape from. I mean, that exists even today. A girl who was born in the brothel quarter to a prostitute will be her prostitute all her life.
So the stratification continues.
It does, yes.
Yes. And how is it that this stratification hangs on in Islamic Pakistan?
And Islam is not supposed to have a caste system. Mm-hmm. In theory, one is not supposed to exist. But in practice, it does. And it doesn't simply apply to the women who are prostitutes and singers and dancers, but it applies to, you know, large numbers of other people. You know, a caste system that operates is not as severe as the caste system that operates in India, even though that caste system is illegal. But nevertheless, you find those social patterns that you find in India have transcended the religious divide. So these social patterns also apply to Islamic societies in South Asia.
Now, the young women of Hira Mandi today, if they wanted to, could they leave?
Very, very difficult. Some of them will find an escape by becoming the wife of somebody who is very powerful, but they will not be the official wife. They will be a second wife or third wife, more like a mistress, I think, rather than a wife. Someone also tried to find a job working in the film industry, and they can amass an awful lot of money by being a successful courtesan or being a successful actress. But the problem is, it's really hard for them to escape from those social origins. Mm. If they're born as the daughter of a prostitute, that follows them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Are girls trained as singers and dancers anymore at all?
A few, but they're not trained very well. In the past, girls would be trained from about 7 or 8, and they would train until about the age of 14 or 15, and then they would enter the business. And after that, they would still carry on training. They would have a tutor who would come to the house to teach them. What happens now is that the girls, by and large, will get a very short training, maybe of about 6 months, and this will start when they're about 13, and it's a preparation for their entering the business, which normally happens around 13 or 14 years old. Mm-hmm. Some of them will also continue to be trained once they've entered the business, but it's nothing like the classical kind of training that girls used to receive. It's more of a training in kind of the kind of dancing that you see in Bollywood films and also in Western kind of cabaret. There is an element of the traditional dancing, but that is really dying away. And I've noticed that even in the few years that I've been working in Hira Mandi.
Yeah. Now, contrast the dancing that we have today that we can think, okay, that's Bollywood. How does that differ from the traditional dancing of old?
The traditional dancing is based upon Kathak, and Kathak dancing is traditional South Asian art form, which is, you know, you have to be highly accomplished to perform it well. It takes years and years of training, and the moves are, you know, extremely highly regulated. There is a story behind the dancing. It's a piece of almost like a theater. And very few women in Hira Mandi can do that today.
Now, why has the elite prostitution and this elite class of singers and dancers, entertainers, why has this been in decline now?
I think it's to do with changes in Pakistani society. What's happened is that the demand for purchased sex, commercial sex, has altered. In the past, it was very much an elite who could afford to buy sex. Now, what's happened is that large numbers of men, because society generally is more prosperous and men have more disposable income, there is a larger number of men who can afford to buy sex. And what's happened is that the elites, at the same time, have changed their focus so that there aren't the same kind of landed elites who are interested in the traditional arts. There are a large number of men who are wealthy but don't have that same interest in traditional arts. Instead, it's more of a kind of materialistic basis to the way that they look at the purchase of sex. So in the past, you would have men who would want to display their status by buying the services of an elite courtesan who could sing wonderful ghazals and traditional songs, who could recite poetry, who could speak perfect, very polished Urdu, and could dance. That was a sign of status in the past. Today, the sign of status for many elite men in Pakistan is to be able to drive around in a four-wheel drive vehicle, either from Japan or from Germany or the UK, and to have Rolex watches and to have, you know, in terms of buying the services of women, to buy women who can speak English, who can pass in 5-star hotels, and who have designer accessories. So the kind of the demand for the elite, the kind of elite prostitution, has changed fundamentally. And at the same time, you know, there's a large demand for sexual services by women who are considered to be of a lower class. And the women from Hiramandi are falling increasingly into that lower class bracket.
So women from a lower class are coming into the district from outside?
It's more that the elite prostitution is in the process of moving out from Hiramandi. So they're moving out to the suburbs, although some of the girls who are still considered elite will live in Hiramandi, but they will visit their clients outside the red light area.
Yeah.
So it's part of the suburbanization of prostitution. In the past, prostitution was very much concentrated in this particular area, Hiramandi, but it's been gradually moving out from Hiramandi. So you've got development of brothels outside the red light area in leafy suburbs, and some of those will be catering to elite men. And you also get the development of brothels in lower class suburbs, which are catering to lower class men.
Hmm. And this is interesting, worth talking about, I think. This has given rise to a professional class of men who manage these women. They're pimps.
Right. Yes. In the past, it was very the trade was very much a trade that was almost like a little kind of cottage industry, in the sense that it was a business managed from home. And it was a business managed by women, because there were no men in these families apart from sons and brothers. There were no fathers, for example. So the heads of the households were always women, and they gave birth to children because as a result of relationships with their clients. And so what happened is that you have, in a kind of complete reversal, if you like, of traditional South Asian society, women heading households, and women also, you know, organizing the careers of their daughters, and also, you know, their sons, or to a limited extent. So women held power in these kind of brothel communities.
Mm.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And what's happened is, with the professionalization, if you like, the industrialization of this sex business, the prostitution, much of the power has been stripped from those traditional families, and importantly, from the older women. Because what happened is that, you know, the managers of the profession were the older women. They were the mothers and the aunts. And now you've got a newer breed of manager moving in, and these are often, not exclusively, but often men who will take over that management role, which in terms of the brothel community renders the older women, the traditional managers of the industry, redundant.
Hmm. And who's behind now? Who are the men now who are running the business?
It's not so much an organized activity in the sense that you would have one big group of men or company or whatever you like to call it organizing it. I think it tends to be men who can see their opportunities, and they're forming networks in order to be able to exploit the women. Mm-hmm. But I must stress that this isn't exclusively a matter of men. It tends to be down at the lower end of the sex business in Hiramandi. It tends to be men who are taking increasing control over the trade. But at the higher levels, it's often women who are doing it.
Hmm.
For example, there are trafficking networks that take girls from Hiramandi to the Gulf states. And many of those trafficking networks are organized by women because women at the higher level of society can move slightly more easily, and there's less suspicion about them.
And this growing industrialization of the sex trade, what has that meant for the quality of life for women in the sex trade?
I think for some young women, it gives them a degree of independence from their families. Now, the families in some respects have been able to protect women. They protect older women because they give them a job as a manager. And in terms of when they put a girl into the business, they will decide when a girl is ready and they will manage her relationships with clients. So in some respects, families in Hiramandi can be protective of girls. But at the same time, they have a vested interest in making sure that girls will enter the trade because they want, in terms of the economic survival of that family, those girls need to be put into the business. But what happens when you've got intermediaries moving in and taking over control of the business? It means that these girls don't have the protection, the protection that's given by their mothers and their aunts. They're seen completely as a commodity, which can be exploited. And then when that girl reaches 30 years old, and it tends to be around that age, she's no longer useful, so she's discarded. In the old system, which was a family-managed system, those women would then have moved into the management of the trade.
Mm.
That's not to say that it's a particularly good life for a woman, but within that community, it's a hell of a lot better than being cast on the scrap heap at 30, and then you've got no one to support you and no kind of social structure to make sure that your basic livelihood and your needs are met.
Yeah. Those women who were tossed on the scrap heap at 30, what became of them?
Many of them will just disappear. I mean, it's very hard to find out what happens to them. Some of them will leave the red light area. They will maybe go and find a new life elsewhere. They will beg. Many of them will also begin to work as domestic servants, errand runners for women who are still in prostitution.
Mm.
And many of them will also die young. So that, if there's no one to support them, there's no one to look after them, when you get to, especially when you get to about 40, these women are basically redundant. They're looking for work as domestic helps, and in which case they will merge into the surrounding community.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Louise Brown. She's a sociologist. Her latest book is The Dancing Girls of Lahore, Selling Love and Saving Dreams in Pakistan's Ancient Pleasure District. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with questions, comments. The phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. How did you meet the family that you profile in this book, The Dancing Girls of Lahore?
It's very easy to meet people in Hiramandi because the women tend to be incredibly friendly. I mean, that is part of the job of being an entertainer. Of being a courtesan, you're interested in meeting people because, you know, maybe there's a chance of meeting, you know, other clients as a result of this. But also because for many of them, they live very circumscribed lives. And so sometimes those lives are quite boring. They're in one or two rooms for most of their lives. And what I used to find is that just walking around in the streets would be a good way of meeting women because they would be looking out, peeping out of their shutters or underneath their bamboo blinds, and they would call me in to have a cup of tea just to find out what I was doing. And that was basically the way that I met Maha and her girls.
Yeah. Well, when the book opens, the year is 2000, and Maha is a woman in her mid-30s, the mother of several children. How many children has she had?
She's had seven children altogether, although only five live with her. She's had, with her one of her first husbands, she had four children, two girls and two boys. And when that marriage broke up, the husband took away the boys, which is often quite unusual in Hiramandi. But he took away the boys, but he left the girls because he knew that he wouldn't be able to find anyone to marry these girls, even if he paid an enormous dowry to be able to get them married off, because they were the daughters of a prostitute.
What happens to the boys, the sons of these women?
For the most part, and it's a very sad story, because in many respects, the lives of the boys are not—they're not as difficult as the girls, obviously, but they are—they're also very restricted because they have a limited education, and they are still known as the children of women from Hiramandi, and so it's very hard for them to, even if they were educated, to be able to get a job in a respectable occupation, to be taken on as apprentice or something, you know, even better than that. Many of them will become pimps and drug pushers, and they will be involved in a life of crime. The money that their sisters will earn and their mothers before them will be the money that, by and large, will sustain them.
Mm. Do any of them become male prostitutes?
Some of them, yes. Yes, they do.
Yeah.
But what tends to happen is in Hiramandi, and this is not perhaps true of some parts of Pakistan, is that there is a large demand for male prostitution, but it tends to be male prostitution of very young boys. And in fact, there are probably more boy prostitutes in Pakistan than there are girl prostitutes. And then there's also more limited demand for sexual services provided by older men. Amongst a very small number, almost like a more modernized, westernized group, that tends to be young men who dress in Western kind of clothes, who are clearly seen as being different than the vast majority of Pakistani men. If you're talking about older men, older male prostitution, you're talking about a group that are known as the Kusras, and these are men who adopt female gender roles, so that they dress as women, they act as if they're women, and they take on a female gender role, but not all of the female gender role. So they will talk in high-pitched voices, they will sway their hips as if they're a very coquettish woman. In fact, they behave in a way in which a normal Pakistani woman would never behave, not even a woman, a female sex worker.
Mm.
And there's quite a high demand for them, but they tend to be categorized on a lower level than most female prostitutes.
Mm.
Although, having said that, there is still a large demand for male prostitution, but it tends to be boy prostitution.
Yeah. How do the religious authorities and government authorities view what's going on?
Well, all sex outside marriage within Pakistan is supposed to be illegal because it's anti-Islamic. And there are actually laws, the Hudud ordinances actually prohibit sex outside marriage. So you can imagine if that's prohibited, you can imagine the attitudes towards prostitution even more extreme. The laws against zina, which is fornication, which encompasses more than simply prostitution. It could encompass adultery or people having sex before they're married. As extreme, it could result in death by stoning, although having said that, I'm not aware of anyone who has actually been officially condemned to stoning by death in Pakistan, but that is a legal possibility. Many of the women who are in jail in Pakistan have been incarcerated because they've had sex with someone who's not their husband. Now, there's a bit of hypocrisy that goes on here. Well, mm-hmm. It's rather a lot of hypocrisy, I should say, in the sense that although sex outside marriage is illegal and prostitution therefore is illegal, you also have a flourishing sex industry. And what's happened is that although prostitution is illegal, in practice it exists, and the authorities turn their eyes away from it for a couple of hours each night when the performance rooms of Hiramandi will open up and girls will dance in the performance rooms. Now, that's not exactly synonymous with prostitution, girls dancing, doing traditional kind of artistic performances. But for most Pakistanis, they know that that is synonymous with prostitution because they know that they can sexual services will be available from these women. But the local authorities, the police in particular, will turn a blind eye to it because they're actively involved in the trade. Mm-hmm. There's this police station right in the middle of Hiramandi, the Tibi Gully police station. And it's alleged, although I don't have any concrete evidence of this, but this is what is repeated, and I can believe it from what I've seen of the conduct of the police in the area, is that police will try to get a posting in the Tibi Gully station because they know that they can run protection rackets, they can take bribes from the local women, and they can also enjoy free sexual servicing. So the authorities are actively involved in the trade in one way or another.
Yeah. It's also interesting to me that this district, Hiramandi, is also sitting next to the old city's biggest, most perfectly proportioned mosque.
That's right. And it's also right next to the Lahore Fort, because these were centers of power. And very importantly, people who went to centers of power in the past would have been the patrons of the dancing girls.
So it was convenient.
Convenient. yes, exactly.
Conveniently located.
You find this in many places throughout the world. You'll have a red light area right next to a fort or a mosque or a church. It's not something that's accidental.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are centers of power. This is where things happen. This is where lots of men congregate. This is where men who have money and have power will congregate. And therefore, you have a red light area right next to it, which is catering to these men.
Well, I want to go back to really the heart of your book, and that is Maha and her family. Her children, you say, are delightful. although there is a very interesting and troubling stratification within the family. There's a very powerful dynamic there at work because the children are from different husbands.
That's right. The older girls are from a very high status father, and they have the traditional kind of high status features that you'd find in South Asian societies, very white skin, whereas one of the younger daughters is the child, I assume, and I don't know this for certain, so I could be wrong, but I am assuming, is from an unknown client. And she's much darker skinned, and she is like the pariah of the family.
You, when you first met her, you thought she was a servant.
That's right. That's right, I did. And she does many of the chores. I think what it is because the children of that first marriage, and it actually wasn't a first sexual encounter, but it was the first long-term relationship that Maha had. Because this relationship was with a high-status man, the children almost have inherited that high status, whereas one of the younger daughters, because she's not associated with that high-status man, she is herself considered to be of low status.
Oh. Now, when we meet her, when we meet the mother, Maha, she's married, but her position is quite precarious, and I think listeners will understand from just what you've been saying why things are so precarious. What was her situation at this point? What was going on?
She had been in a series of relationships with men. She had been trained, not in the kind of traditional sense for many, many years, but she'd had at least 3 or 4 years training in singing and dancing, and she's a very accomplished singer. She'd been through a series of relationships, but what tends to happen is that women, or should I say girls, are in highest demand when they're teenagers. And as they get older, their value declines. And so what happens is that a patron, a client, will take on a girl from Hiramandi when she may be 17 or 18. He will keep her, look after her for 2 or 3 years, and then when she gets a little bit older, he will discard her and he will take on another younger girl. So what happens is that the women constantly work their way down the kind of, if you like, the social and economic hierarchy of the men, of the clients. So that she might start off with a very rich and wealthy, high-status patron, but you know, as she gets older, she will end up maybe after 20 years with a man who is a drug addict, who has very little money, who treats her very badly, and has very low social status. Now, what was happening to Maha at that time is that she was being discarded by her latest long-term client, actually somebody who had married her. But he had married her, and she was, I think, his third wife. And so it was someone that he could easily divorce without creating any kind of scandal. And this is accepted. You know, if a man will marry somebody from Hiramandi as the second and third wife, everyone knows that it's a short-term mistress. So for Maha, it was very, very difficult because she'd had several children from previous relationships. She'd had 2 children from the relationship she was currently in, the relationship was actually ending, and she'd been sent back from a nice house out in the suburbs, and she'd been sent back to Hiramandi with all the children. And because she relied totally on support from this man, it meant that life was absolutely desperate for her, because there was no other man to replace the husband.
Mm-hmm.
And the girls at the same time were not old enough to enter the business. So in many respects, in terms of the Hiramandi, they were old enough to enter the business, at least the older one, but the older girl was sick, so that she couldn't have entered the business. She had what we thought was TB at the time.
Yeah. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but when Maha entered the business, she was 12?
She was 12, yes. And that is, it's not uncommon, although what tends to happen is that girls enter the business around 14. Maha was a little bit younger than most. But what had happened is that her older sister, who was about 14, had been sent to have her virginity sold to a very powerful Arab sheikh. And the girl, when she was deflowered, she didn't bleed, so she was sent home in disgrace. And the agents who had sent her were extremely annoyed. So what happened was that Maha was then sent as a kind of compensation. Mm. And so she lost her virginity when she was 12.
Yeah. Over the course of the 4 years you spent getting to know Maha and her children, what happened to them?
That's a really complicated and big question.
And the time is flying by, but, you know, in the end, what are Maha's options?
She doesn't have any options.
Yeah.
She really doesn't. She has no other options but to put her daughters into prostitution, because that's what generations of women in her family have done, and that's the way they survive. And it's not as if they can say, oh, let's change our career now, let's go and do something else, because they're born into that, and if you're born into that occupation in Pakistan, you stay in it. No one wants to help you. It's very difficult for a woman, unless you're from the elite class and you're highly educated and you can have a career. And that, we're talking there about a tiny proportion of women. Most women will survive economically by getting married and having their husband support them, although many women do work, but they work within their homes. So for Maha, it's not a simple matter of changing career, because women of her class don't have careers. They are wives and they are mothers.
Hmm.
So now what's happened to Maha and her family is that there has been a generational transition during the time that I've been following them. And so that now Maha has retired from the business and the girls have now entered it. And so that they're now working just in the same trade as their mother did 20 years before. The oldest girl is actually too ill to work. And I was back in Hiramandi just a few months ago, in August and September. And the older girl is very ill. Basically, she's got arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, and a variety of other things as well. She won't take the medicine to make herself well because she doesn't want to have to be in the business.
Mm.
So she just stays at home all the time, getting sicker and sicker. The next daughter is the star of Islamabad. She has now become the toast, the toast of Lahore, the elite, at least in terms of men, Lahori and Lahori society. She has the phone numbers of many of Pakistan's most powerful men. She's 17 years old. That, of course, that position as a kind of a young woman in demand, it will fade away in 2 or 3 years' time. But at the moment, she's making an awful lot of money.
Will she have children? When will she have children?
She has this dream of working in the business for a few years and then meeting some wonderful man who's going to whisk her away. And then she's going to live in America and she's going to have 2 children. And I don't think it's going to happen, but that's her dream.
Yeah.
And the younger girl, the one who is slightly different than the other two girls, the one who is more at the prior of the family, she's actually pregnant. She's 16 years old. And everyone is praying that the child is going to be a girl, because it's another generation of courtesans to support the family.
You know, on the one hand, you admire these women. They are so tough and smart and charming. On the other hand, one wonders, will this ever change? Can they ever break out?
I think it will. But it will take time, and I do know of a couple of examples of women who have been able to break out of this, but they have to escape from Pakistan.
Oh.
That doesn't sound very encouraging, I know, but I think these changes may come to Pakistan in time. I know of a couple of girls whose mothers have done extremely well. And, I mean, these are exceptions. They are not typical of women of Hiramandi at all. And they've been able to travel to the UK and also to Canada. And so they have escaped that cycle. And that's what it is. It's a cycle that some, you know, these women are locked into prostitution. The vast majority, though, I can't see it changing very soon because it takes a massive cultural shift. I think it's only going to change when the women have enough money to be able to sustain them away from Hiramandi in a meaningful sense. And I think this is only going to come with, you know, we often talk about processes of globalization being very negative, but in many respects, this is one way that, you know, globalization might be good in the sense that those traditional values of people being born into a caste, into a group, and staying with that the whole life, maybe broken down.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're past the time. Louise Brown, thank you very much for speaking with me
this afternoon.
Louise Brown is the author of The Dancing Girls of Lahore, Selling Love and Saving Dreams in Pakistan's Ancient Pleasure District. The book is published by Fourth Estate, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri-Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandagrienergy.com.
It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and this afternoon I will be bringing you the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Let's begin with the day trade for the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat, today's high 308.5, the low 304.5, the settlement 306.75, down 1/4. March 324, the high 320, the low, the settlement 322.5, down 3/4. May wheat 332.5, that the high, the low 329.5, the settlement 331.5, down 1/2. July 340.5, the high, the low 337.25, the settlement 339.5, down 1. September wheat 348.5, the high 346.5, the low 348, the settlement that down 1/2. December corn 196, the high 192.25, the low, the settlement 192.75, down 3. March corn 210, the high 206, the low, the settlement 206.75, down 3.25. May 218, the high 214.5, the low 215.5, the settlement that down 2.5. July 225.25, the high 221.75, the low 222.25, the settlement that down 3. September 233.5, the high 230.25, the low, the settlement 230.75, down 2.75. December 244.75, the high 240.75, the low 241.25, the settlement that down 3. December oats 166.25, the high 164, the low 164.75, the settlement that down 1/2. March 173.5, the high 172, the low 172.75, the settlement that up 1/2. January beans 591, the high 574, the low 576.75, the settlement that down 15.5. March 597.5, the high 581.5, the low 584.75, the settlement that down 14.5. May 602.5, the high 588, the low 590, the settlement that down 15.25. July 609.5, the high 593.5, the low 596.75, the settlement that down 13.75. August 610.5, the high 596.5, the low, the settlement 6 even, that down 12.5. September 610, the high 597, the low 597, the settlement that down 15. November 615, the high 6.5, the low 603.5, the settlement that down 13. December meal 197.70, Let me go back on that one here. December meal, 179.70, the high, 172.20, the low, 173.40, the settlement, that down 680. January, 180.30, the high, 173.50, the low, the settlement, 174.40, that down 690. December soybean oil, 22.39, the high, 22.17, the low, 22.19, the settlement, that down 15. And January oil, 22.60, the high, 22.38, the settlement, 22.43, let me go back on this one. All these numbers today, I'm not used to reading so many. January soybean meal, soybean oil, 22.60, the high, 22.38, the low, 22.43, the settlement, that down 10. Thanks for bearing with me here this afternoon. Coming up in just a moment, I'll have the numbers from the Merck.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Okay, now let's take a look at the livestock contracts. Livestock mixed today. November feeder cattle, the high 116.50, the low 116.20, the settlement 116.47.5, that up 10. January 114.60, the high 113.62.5, the low 114.52.5, the settlement, that up 15. March 112.80, the high, the low 112 even, the settlement 112.80, that up 10. December live cattle 91.85, the high 91.05, the low 91.70, the settlement, that unchanged. February live cattle 94.70, the high 93.85, the low, the settlement 94.62.5, that up 15. December lean hog 64 even, the high 62.75, the low, the settlement 63.10, that down 75. February 67.40, the high 66.35, the low, finishing at 66.92.5, down 22.5. April 68.15, the high 67.40, the low, the settlement 67.85, that down 32.5. May lean hog 69.40, the high 68.90, the low 69.22.5, the settlement, that down 17.5. February pork bellies 90 even, the high 87.75, the low 88.75, the settlement, that unchanged. And now let's check on the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500. The Dow is down 11 points at 10,675. The NASDAQ off 1 point at 2185. The S&P 500 is 2 higher at 1231.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Verde Gallery, currently featuring Into the Mystic, an exploration of art and spirituality, which includes local, national, and international artists, plus other events. Also featuring a bluegrass jam every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom, 17 East Taylor, downtown.